Infirmary Media.
Art. People engage in Stafford Duel in decades. The Matrix and Blade versus Bloodsport and Renegade. Strap on that cap, bust out the power glove. Come fight for what you love.
Duel in decades.
Poop culture popping pins, dropping hand grenades. Van Halen locked in Mortal Kombat with David Gray. Spanner out ballet and sick, Iron Maiden, GNR. Come fight for what you love.
Duel in decades.
Broadcasting from the Podcast New York studios, it's the adult-only retro game show where the decades battle for supremacy. Because it's your history, we just fight for it. Welcome back to Dueling Decades. I am Mark James, and this week I will be representing the final week of November 1992 in this week experience battle. So let's meet this week's other duelers and the decades they will be fighting for. First off, coming off a loss last week and looking to leave the Loser's Lounge, say hello to Man Crush.
What's up? That's right. I got November 23rd through the 30th of 1981. 1981 is one of those years, every time I get it, I just feel like it's going to be a bad year. Let's see if I'm wrong. I don't know. It might be, might not be.
Also on the panel this week, please welcome back the beautiful, bald, and bearded Bo Beecraft.
Ah, yes. Great to be back here to avenge my losing streak and hopefully stay in the L column this week with November 24th through the 30th, 1973.
And as always here on the show, we need somebody to adjudicate all of this awesomeness, so you will know this week's celebrity guest judge as the frontman from the band The Presidents of the United States of America. All rise and welcome Casper Baby Pants himself, Judge Chris Ballou.
I'm going to be harsh, too. Harsh.
Ooh, man.
Ladies and gentlemen, the following contest will be held under Dueling Decades rules. A judge's coin flip shall decide who picks first out of the five Dueling Decades categories: movies, television, music, news, and hot products. A judge's ruling will determine who wins each round, allowing the victor to choose the next available category. The first three rounds are worth 1 point each, with rounds 4 and 5 worth 2 points apiece. And in the event of a tie, after all five rounds, we'll go to a final wild card round. All right, duelers, if you're down with OPP, let's play some more
Dueling Decades.
Yeah.
All right, let's toss it right down to Judge Chris Ballou for the coin toss.
Okay, here we go. I'll be using a copy of my latest Casper Baby Pants album, which just came out November 13th, Happy Heart. Is the name of the album. It's my 18th album in 10 years. So I'm not slacking. You know, I'm a tackle. Here we go.
All right, Bo Beecraft, why don't you call it in the air?
Oh, me? Well, what a guest of honor, I feel like. Let's go with heads.
Okay, I got to do it again. Here we go. Yep. Heads it is.
Oh, my Woo! God. What a miracle.
All right, Bo Beecraft, you win the coin toss, and you get to select our first category. Where are we going?
I'm going to go with hot products. Just get it out of the way. Man Crush told me we're going to go with Black Friday sales essentially this year because, you know, it's kind of weird. So I mentioned that I have 1973, which was just absolute garbage. So I don't have a lot of hope for this contest on my end. But I will lead with this. Hot products from Black Friday, if they technically called it that back in 1973, from the Fort Collins, Coloradoan. Are you guys ready for this? An extra firm quilted top Simmons king size set on sale for $278, priced at $278. Wow. Super firm, 78 by 80 inches of an inner spring mattress, 3-layer deep comfort, extra thick, just like those who lay on it, resilient coils to give pampered sleeping all night, and styled with a lovely floral ticking, crush proof borders, and 2 twin size box springs included. $278. I mean, for all intents and purposes, you couldn't buy a king size mattress that was decent for $278 today.
I think it costs more than that to get rid of a mattress.
I think the bed frame costs more than that.
Well, it's also 1973, so you're looking at like $1,000.
Yeah.
Roughly.
Well, yeah. Is that I'm always watching TV shows and trying to do the calculations. I think like early 70s is about 8 times. So you might be, you might be right. I think
it's a lot of dough.
Yeah, that's a lot of money.
Sounds like a good mattress, though.
Well, I mean, you're really paying for the floral pattern more than anything.
Which you will never see.
Right, because, well, you got to keep the plastic on it. Everybody knows that. You want to preserve the furniture, not ruin it, not utilize it.
Exactly.
My mom actually kept the plastic on our couches in the 70s and early 80s. Everything had like that. She's Italian.
She just pulled it off last year. It's in mint condition.
Yeah, she probably did.
My parents put plastic on me for the first 5 years.
And you made it.
I made it. I poked little holes in it so I could see.
All right, Man Crush, let's hear what you have for the hot products round.
All right, so let's go to November 27th of 1981. Like Bo mentioned before, we did things a little bit different with hot products this episode. Even though the term like Black Friday was just in its infancy in 1981, it's always been touted as the day about, you know, retailers have their best sales and they want to pull the numbers into the black. So with that, we decided to go with the best Black Friday sales that we wanted to bring to the table. And for me, this was an easy one. This product popped up on one of the first newspapers that I looked at, and it was perfect. And on the show, I talk about the Man Crush 3 quite often. And the RCA CD player that I watched all three of these movies on, I never had the opportunity to select this piece of technology that was basically like my babysitter for years on end growing up. This is a Black Friday ad from the infamous Montgomery Ward, which happened to be my first legal job ever, where you can get an RCA CD player for $111 off the MSRP. That's right. Now you could be watching The Man Crush 3, Friday the 13th, Airplane, and Grease on repeat like me for the mere price of $388, ooh, which is around $1,111 in 2020. So that's a damn steal. 100% electronic, fully automatic, easier than a record player to operate. The CD system with the Diamond Stylus produces a sharp, undistorted picture, soft touch function controls, pause, visual search, scans 12 times the normal speed in forward or reverse, rapid access, which you also have at any point. You can get 120 times the normal speeds. If you want to skip right to the end, you could. Now, on that same ad, there's also an ad for a video cassette player. This is not my pick, but I just want to throw this out there, which was twice the price on sale for $650.
That's what you got to pay to get them now.
Yeah, which is probably why my parents had the RCA, because sadly they couldn't afford that. But, you know, even sadder than that, that VCR would eventually kill the RCA disc in the end. And it's too bad for RCA, because this is one of those stories where the company dragged their feet and dragged, you know, kind of took too long to bring this to market. When it was finally released, it was March of 1981, and it already had been in development for over 15 years at that point. And matter of fact, they ran their first prototype in 1972. So it just makes you think there, if you got a good idea, just go with it. Because you might have had some decent lineage with that, but they didn't. And this kind of has legs because Mike Ranger just drove 4 hours. So you can get our very own RCA disc player at Podcast New York Studios, and it's glorious. We post that to our Instagram and our private Facebook group. So if you go to www.facebook.com/DuelingDecades, join the group, you'll see the photos in there. But my pick, the RCA CED player.
All right. So for my hot product, we're going to go over to the Tucson Citizen, November 26, 1992. Whole slew of Black Friday ads, all kinds of different stores, and one in particular catches my eye by the huge headline, Cowabunga, excellent prices. So for the low price of $15.96 on Black Friday, you could pick up the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Party Wagon by Playmates. Now, the description for this product is exactly the same description I like to see on all my wife's clothing. It says freewheeling and has a flip top open for easy access. And also included with that, for $39.96, you could get the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Technodrome. You know, it's the Foot Clan's fortress, has rolling spy radar, a trick door, and weapons room. Unfortunately, the figures and ooze is not included, so you're going to have to supply your own ooze. But that's what I wanted for my hot products, 1992 Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles action figures. If I had to pick, though, between the Technodrome and the Party Wagon, Man, I got to go with the Party Wagon.
You can have a Technodrome installed in your Party Wagon.
I could. That would make now you're onto something.
I mean, I don't know what I'm talking about, but it sounds like you probably if you had enough money sitting around, you could probably hire somebody to install that in your Party Wagon.
All right, so let's toss it down to Chris Ballou for the ruling on the Hot Products round.
Oh, this is a tough one, man. There's some really great stuff going on here, but I gotta go with Man Crush. I gotta go with the technology advancement at that point in time, and the story of stalling with development is such a classic issue. I'm sure that they just thought if they just honed it a little further, it would just be perfect, and they waited too long. And that is a compelling story. So, Minecraft, this round goes to you.
I really thought the mattress was going to seal the deal. I really did. Yeah, I thought it was going to take this round.
And we all sleep, you know, a third of our lives.
I know. It's a no-brainer pick. I'm disappointed, to say the least.
Chris, this was the first one that I ever had. This is the first, like, entertainment system I had in my house. And we lived by it. Like, we had a ton of movies for it. Do you remember what the first one you ever had was? Did you have, like, a VCR or Betamax?
Boy, no. My parents never went in for that stuff. My neighbor, my good friend, lived down the street, and his parents had all the stuff we didn't have. So my mom got adult onset diabetes in the early 70s, and she was all into health food and no, like, you know, processed foods and all that stuff. My neighbors, my best friend and his family, had like hot dogs and pepperoni and VCRs and, you know, like everything we didn't have. So I had nothing like that until I went to my neighbor's house and enjoyed watching, you know, Airplane whenever we wanted. Or what?
Yes.
So, yeah, I was technologically challenged, and no cookies either until I was old enough to make my own.
Ouch. Well, you can go. You can, if you drive 4 hours like Mike Ranger, you could find your own RCA CD player, even though ours doesn't work. It's got a broken belt.
Ugh.
And tragic. Funny story. Mike Ranger actually contacted RCA via Twitter and asked them if they had replacement belts. But I will, this shout out to RCA. They didn't completely blow him off. They pointed him in the direction of Facebook groups. They actually sent him a Facebook group that's all about like vintage electronics or whatever. And the people there actually helped him out and told him what to buy.
Nice.
So shout out to RCA for that one and for helping me win that round.
Boy, that's unusual in the days of, like, you know, even the latest, you know, OS on my computer becomes obsolete in, you know, 2 years.
Yeah. they're like screw off
software.
Yeah, exactly. I was shocked. I mean, he did it as a gag, like contacting them, but good on them. I mean, that's pretty awesome. Right. Supporting something that's 29 years old.
RCA stands for really cool audiophiles.
All right, Man Crush, you pick up a point, but more importantly, you take control of the board and get to select our next category.
All right, let's go to news. Let's get news out of the way here. Let's go to November 28th, 1981, which is a Saturday. And this was a huge deal at the time. And frankly, it was bigger than anything that was going on Thanksgiving week in 1981. Unfortunately, this man's record was eventually broken. This guy, he broke a record. But it doesn't take away from the fact that he accomplished this in 38 seasons as a college football coach. And when you're talking about college football coaches, this man's name and his legacy, they live on forever. This guy literally lived for college football. He retired from coaching 1 year after he broke this record for most victories, and he died a month later. That's just crazy when people work their entire lives and they stop and they just die. I don't want to bring the sadness here. I'll bring it back up, but like,
you're getting close.
It just shows
Man
you
Crush
how much he was living for it. But the title of this article, simple name, 315 is the title of this article. And it's Alabama's Bear Bryant now stands alone as the winningest coach in college football history. And after registering his 315th triumph on Saturday, when the fourth-ranked Crimson Tide struck for two quick touchdowns in the final quarter to pull out a 28-17 victory over Auburn, Bryant said he wouldn't have it any other way. And I quote him here. He says, "It proves to our players that they have class and character, and it shows them what can be done in the future," said Bryant. And as he has all season, The Bear played it cool and low key, although he did concede that the record-breaking victory was a big relief. And I quote him here. He said, "I just want to go home, get some milk and bread and an onion, and watch the game on television.
Story of my life."
"I hope my granddaughter got it right on the video recorder." Who eats and drinks milk, bread, and an onion together? I guess the winningest coach in college football history in 1981. But, you know, I mean, you look at this. 315 wins is remarkable. It's a remarkable milestone. Even by today's standards, where he's listed as the eighth all-time winningest football coach, you always hear about, like, he was a no-nonsense type guy. And obviously, like, many people know the stories about the Junction Boys and how he tortured people through summer camp. However, this man also battled for years trying to get his teams integrated between the blacks and whites. You know, he would fight with administration at almost every school. Actually, every school he went to. He was a coach of Kentucky, Texas A&M, and then finally Alabama before Alabama finally integrated in 1971. So just think about how many more wins Bear Bryant could have had if his teams were integrated the previous 25 years at that point. He probably would have been closer to the top, if not at the top of the list. But this is Bear Bryant's 315th win.
Wow. Inspiring.
All right, Bo Beecraft, what did you bring for the news round?
I brought this. Sorry, it's mental lapse there.
I get a feeling it's not going to be as inspiring.
Probably not. I don't know. There might be some niche listeners out there that might find this interesting. November 27th, 1973, the United States Senate votes 92-3 to confirm Gerald Ford as the Vice President of the United States. This after former VP Spiro Agnew resigns from the position, pleading no contest to criminal charges of tax evasion and money laundering, part of a negotiated resolution to a scheme in which he accepted, well, quite a bit of money in today's standards, but back then $29,500, which equates to, in 2020, about $229,000 in bribes while he was the governor of Maryland. According to the New York Times, the President Richard Nixon at the time sought advice from senior congressional leaders about a replacement for the VP vacancy. He received the advice that was pretty unanimous in recommending Gerald Ford. He agreed to the nomination. He told his wife that the vice presidency would be, quote, a nice conclusion to his career. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. Ford was then nominated to take the position on October 12th. The Senate confirmation vote was held on the previously mentioned November 27th. And on December 6th, 1973, the House confirmed Ford by a vote of 387-35, after which he took the oath of office as the vice president of the United States. And then, short time later, he became the he became the vice president as the whole Watergate thing was happening. So they really, well, he just kind of did the whole thing very quickly.
He was fast
tracked. Yeah, he had the abbreviated version of vice presidency and presidency. So on Thursday, August 1st, 1974, Chief of Staff Alexander Haig contacted Ford to tell him, "Hey, you're probably going to be the president. Some shit's about to go down. Put your presidential cap on, and then the rest is history." But that is my pick for news. November 27th, 73, Senate voting 92-3 to confirm Gerald Ford as the VP.
Wow. Woo. Wow. He had to put his big boy pants on fast.
Yeah, okay. Just throw him right to the wolves.
All right, so for my news story, we're going to go over to the Boston Globe, Friday, November 27th, 1992. The news story I found, kind of a bit of an odd one. I got kind of have the Black Friday still stuck in my head. You know, I wanted to pick something that we've never really done on this show before, and I thought this was kind of interesting. And as far as Christmas gifts go, this might be something you want to consider. A whale of a holiday gift. Adopt an endangered finback. Out of Bar Harbor, Maine, a marine mammal research lab has a gift for the person who has everything. A finback whale. Allied Whale is offering whales for adoption to raise money for its research activities. Adoptive parents don't actually get the whales, which are among the largest animals on Earth and can grow up to 80 feet in length. What they do get is a color photograph, a certificate of adoption, a biography, and a sighting history of their whale. Adoption of the whale costs $30. Adopting a mother and a calf costs $50. The Adopt-A-Whale Finback program gives the public an opportunity to participate in whale conservation by directly supporting research of its scientists by studying these animals. So here you go. If you want to, if you're looking for that hard to find last minute Christmas gift for somebody, you could adopt a whale.
It'd be even better if it was if it was a whale sized chia pet. Just grow like fields of alfalfa sprouts.
And interestingly enough, if you're interested in this, this program is still going on. If you go over to coa.edu, that's the College of the Atlantic in Bar Harbor, Maine, they still have the Adopt a Whale program. You can get this for your loved one this year.
Technically, it's pronounced Bahaba.
Well, the funny thing is my wife lived up there during this time. She remembers this promotion. If you want to get a whale for a loved one today, good news, the price has actually dropped. It's at now only $30 for a single whale adoption, and you get a $10 discount now if you want to adopt the mother and the calf. That's only $40.
I have a feeling that if we left Trump to his own devices, he would take credit for that too.
How many disappointed phone calls?
Yeah, whale prices have dropped. It's amazing.
We can start using their blubber again for fuel,
for lamps.
Yeah, it might come to that. It might come to that, yeah.
All right, let's toss it down to Chris Ballew for the ruling on the news round.
Okay, you know, I'm really feeling the Gerald Ford story from Bo Beecraft because I didn't know about the whole confirmation process and how fast that whole transformation happened for him and how unaware he was of the potential for that transformation. So, yeah, I think that one left me with my jaw on the ground, and I will have to salute it as the winner.
All right. Well, gentlemen, it's been a lot of fun. I think I'm just going to wrap it up, take my earnings, and call it a day. Mm-hmm. And on a high note.
All right, Bo Beecraft, you tie up this game with Man Crush, and you get to select our next category.
Let's go with music, shall we? November 26, 1973. The fifth studio album from the British outfit Badfinger, titled Ass. Unfortunately, the album prior to this one was named Straight Up, and there was no album in between titled You to make a fitting trilogy of Badfinger's Straight Up Your Ass. All besides the point, this was the final appearance for the band on the music label Apple before they moved on to Warner Brothers. They would also be Apple's final original release that was not by an ex-member of the Beatles, which not really relevant, but I found interesting. It peaked at number 122 on the Billboard 200 in the U.S. The single Apple of My Eye only peaked at number 102 on Billboard's Bubbling Under chart in America, which Bubbling Under just sounds like, well, these aren't that great, but we're going to go ahead and rank them anyway. The album's opener, Apple of My Eye, is said to have been written based around the band's somewhat tumultuous relationship with the Apple label. I guess they were probably, you know, kind of given a bill of goods that never really was, you know, followed up on. The album art also depicted a donkey with a massive carrot dangling in front of it, which was supposed to represent that whole thing, the whole discrepancies with their publishing and the label handling and all that good stuff. I had to choose between this and the fourth album from Manfred Mann's Earth Band. So obviously my forever junior high mentality is going to go with, you know, something called Badfinger and Ass. Yeah, for what it's worth, though, Day After Day and No Matter What by Badfinger, two of my all-time favorite songs, even though they were released prior to the opus that was titled Ass in November 26, 1973.
Wow. Oof.
Yeah, follow that one up, suckers.
We were stunned in the silence, I gotta say. The whole bad fingers, asses, and it's just my mind is swirling.
All right, Man Crush, let's see how you follow that one with the music round.
Man, I don't know how I could, but let's go to November 23rd of 1981. We get the eighth studio album from this Hall of Fame band. I had to check back to previous episodes since Mark had selected their previous two albums, but this particular album has never surfaced on the show. And in all seriousness, though, this is probably the best thing to come out of that Thanksgiving week in 1981. Kind of like what Bo was saying before, it's a pretty shitty week, but this is pretty massive for that week. The band was just coming off their largest album to date, arguably their best album, an album that went 25 times platinum at the time. So how do they follow that up? Well, for starters, you get the same producer. you've been using for the last couple albums. You get Mutt Lange. You bring him back. You write more songs about sex, and you keep it hard as ever. You know what I'm saying? This album happens to be the band's first ever number one hit on the U.S. Billboard 200. It sold roughly 7 million copies worldwide, went 4 times platinum in the U.S., featured 2 dynamite singles. And the thing that I always loved about this band, they just went out and made fun music. I know they've gotten knocked over the years for being too like simple-minded with their lyrics, but I've always likened this band to 80s action movies. They're awesome. You know, you don't have to waste time trying to figure out what the plot of the movie is. 80s action movies had lots of explosions, sex, and a huge kill count. AC/DC has lots of screaming guitar solos, sex, and over-the-top vocals. So what's not to like there? The Kings of Testosterone-filled anthems are back this time for Those About to Rock. We salute you. Brian Johnson's second album with the band. It's really fun listening. I listened to it again today. The Young Brothers are amazing as usual. Phil Rudd utterly destroys the drums like he's firing a shotgun. And then, of course, he's got the amazing title track to close out every show for AC/DC. It's the release of For Those About to Rock. We Salute You, released November 23rd, 1981.
Solid. Such a fantastic album.
A decent follow-up to Badfinger, yeah. If I had to say so myself.
I tried to keep it on par.
I mean, if Badfinger, they were only bad in the finger.
Right.
AC/DC was bad in the whole body. I mean bad meaning good, not good meaning bad or whatever. Run DMC said it. I mean that.
All right, gentlemen. So for my music selection, you know, in 1992, this band, whose lead singer, I might add, is a former Dueling Decades judge, was coming off their smash hit 1991 debut studio album. So Epic Records revamps their out-of-print original live EP, adds some smoking new tracks recorded live at the friendly confines of the Wetlands in New York City, and released November 24th, 1992. I present to you Homebelly Groove, live by the Spin Doctors. Fantastic follow-up album. You know, the highlight for this album for me is the opening track, What Time Is It? Off My Line. 12 minutes, segued together. It's a nice melody of those two songs. And the rendition of Little Miss Can't Be Wrong, another standout track on this album. If you were a fan of it from Pocketful of Kryptonite, you're going to love the live version. And that's what I really liked about Homebelly Groove. If you heard Pocketful of Kryptonite and you really liked it, this is what the band sounded like in their natural habitat. So if you go down to Wetlands and you saw the shows or you followed Spin Doctors on the road, this is what they sounded like, and it's absolute perfection. So that's what I got for 1992, Homebelly Groove Live by the Spin Doctors.
How many bands have we had on here? When you said that, I was like, well, it's not Robert Tepper in 1992. So I kind of figured it had to be Chris Barron. Who else have we had on band-wise? Now I'm feeling like our band numbers are low. We're going to have to pick them up.
AJ Popoff from Lit was just on recently.
But that was later 90s. Yeah, that was like later. 98.
Yeah.
Who else? Like, I feel like I'm brain farting on this one.
Yeah, I don't know. I hit potholes all the time, man.
Yeah, Chris, you're in like a small group, man. You can like really do it up right here. Robert Tepper's been on like, I don't know, 3 times or something. That guy is awesome. But yeah, we got to get more bands on.
Yeah.
What are the guys from Bread doing?
All right, let's toss it down to Chris Ballou for the ruling on the music round.
Okay, so I think I'm going to have to go with Man Crush on this one. Number one, the description of the band in question was so long without saying who it was. I was sure you were talking about Def Leppard. Laying in there, and I was just like, okay, lyrics are simple, but it's great. It's like 80s explosion movies. It's got to be Def Leppard. And then it's AC/DC, which is close to my heart. You know, I grew up in a Catholic household, and I sort of became, you know, as I got older, I became a little like, I don't know if this is actually the thing, you know, that I believe in. But my mom was so into it, she used to bribe me to go to mass. And then later I became an altar boy, and she bribed me to do that. And it came to a head when the prize for the bribe of going to be an altar boy was AC/DC's Back in Black on vinyl. And I looked at that album and I was just like, something is horribly wrong here. I need to I need to move on. If she's buying me this, if this is my prize for being an altar boy. So AC/DC warms my heart perennially for that reason alone. So yeah, just, you know, from personal experience and from the cliffhanger introduction, which led me astray, I got to go with Man Crush.
Listeners to this show will know that as the Man Crush signature.
Yeah. Yeah. I love to drag it out. It's the best way to do it. But you know what? Like, that's really good. I didn't even think about that. But Def Leppard definitely falls into that category, I believe.
Yeah, I thought for sure. I mean, I thought the next comment was going to be like, despite the drummer losing an arm.
I was either thinking that or Kiss possibly as well, who's been picked a few times. As
true. Right? That's why I threw it out. I threw that one out there for you, Mark, to see if you would know who it is off the bat. But did your mom read those lyrics before she bought you the album?
No, I just said what I learned and she bought it. I mean, I used to say like, I want a tape recorder. I want a distortion pedal. I want this and that. And then eventually I was like, I want Back in Black by AC/DC on vinyl. And she's like, great.
You should have asked for a VCR and some junk food.
I should have. In a mattress.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah.
Quilted top, floral pattern, you know, go all out.
Yeah, yeah, come on, man. It's like $278.
The same thing happened to my cousin. We were probably about the same age. Were you like what, like early teen years?
I was born in 65, so what we're saying 81, I was 16, yeah.
Okay, so you were like in high school. My cousin, my aunt bought him the Faith No More Epic album. And it was the same thing. I forgot what she bribed him for, but she bought him the album. And I copied it at the time because I was 2 years younger than he was. And we're listening to it all the time. And she pulled the tape and started reading the lyrics and was like, what did I buy?
Yeah.
And I was like,
what? Oh, actually, though, I got to amend that because Back in Black, when did Back in Black come out?
That was 80. It was a year before this album.
Okay, so I was 15. That was when 15 is when... Yeah, the curtain came down. when I saw the man behind the curtain, or whatever Wizard of Oz, you know, referencing I use for your relationship to God.
All right, Man Crush, you pick up another point going into our first 2-point round. What category are we going with?
All right, let's go to television for the first one. Let's finish up with movies. So we're going to go November 24th, 1981. This show I watched sparingly through the 80s because it was the lead-in for Magnum PI. Solid show about a couple private investigators in San Diego who happen to be brothers, totally opposite brothers to boot. The show ended up lasting for 8 seasons, 156 episodes, and it would have some solid ratings, peaking at the 5th highest rated show by the 3rd season. So obviously this is a show that some people liked, you know, otherwise it wouldn't have lasted 8 seasons on CBS. However, since Mark's been doing this, I did the same thing here. I bring you this asshat critic, Lee Winfrey of the Philadelphia Inquirer, to sum up the show for everybody. And the title of this article is, If You Watch Simon and Simon, You'll Likely Wish You Had Not.
Okay, I thought you were going to say Def Leppard. Okay, so Simon and Simon, not Def Leppard's short-lived sitcom.
I mean, if you listen to what this guy says, you would never watch it. He says, Simon and Simon is simple and silly. Simon and Simon is a half-baked, all turkey into a fall television season already plagued by poorly done crime series. It fails like another affliction. Simon and Simon will premiere at 8 p.m. tomorrow night on CBS. I hope you have something better to do. Let's skip a little bit forward. He says, he's talking about bars, like, to lead up to this point. So he says, if you watch the premiere of Simon and Simon, you may wish that you were at the bar and the bartender could pour you a cold one. This series might push a preacher towards the tap. And then he finishes it up with he's all over this show. He says, the intellectual content of Simon and Simon is summed up by the opening credits, which feature a truck flying through the air. It probably reaches a higher altitude than Simon and Simon will achieve in the Nielsen ratings. This dog of a show also includes a dog in its cast. His name is Marlo, and he weighs an intimidating 125 pounds. And in case you were curious, he's part St. Bernard and part Great Dane. I'm sorry that he's leashed to this mutt of a series, but I guess that's a dog's life. This guy just rips it for like an entire page. I just had to clip out a couple ports, but I didn't think it was that bad. I mean, I watched it because I liked Magnum PI, so I would like flip on the show early. And of course, until like, you know, the Cosbys came out in 84, and then you kind of gave up on the show. And of course, that's when they ended up moving the nights around. But this is a show that lasted 8 seasons. And this guy just shits on
Simon and Simon has one of my favorite theme songs.
Oh, it's awesome.
Dead serious. I love it.
How does it go, Bo? I don't remember.
Just look it up. You'll, because you want to watch it. You want to watch it with the video.
Yeah. Well, it's an improvement on the original Simon and Simon, which was just two Simon games sitting next to. Yeah, that was.
There's actually a great skit for this from Adult Swim. I think it was like 5 or 6 years ago.
The greatest television event.
The greatest television event. It's they recreate the opening sequence of the show with was it Jack Hamm?
It was John Hamm and
John Hamm
and
that the one dude guy from Parks and Rec, Adam whatever his name is. It's Adam my decade. I don't, Adam whatever from Parks and Rec, but Paul Rudd's like the director and he quit. It's a great skit. It's like 10 minutes. You probably find it on YouTube, but. If you're never going to watch Simon and Simon, at least check that clip out.
The guitar tone in the theme song sells it. I mean, it's pure, like, nostalgia.
Well, I could picture you driving that truck with the big old bumper thing in the front.
Look, it's no Fall Guy truck, but it's second not. Close favorite in pop culture. Big pickups.
Okay, and I got to say that as far as terrible television shows, I think mine that I'm going to cite right about now was in the 70s. I think it was 78. It was called Holmes and Yo-Yo. Anybody? No, anybody?
I haven't heard of it.
John Shuck from MASH played a robotic human who could blink his eyes and take pictures, and a Polaroid would come out of his shirt pocket. He was a detective. He was a robot detective assigned to a partner who had been notoriously hard to get along with his partners. And I loved the show, and then I did a little research, and it was only on for 3 months. And I think as a kid, I watched every episode, and I loved it. And it was touted as one of the worst television shows in the history of TV. And I was a super fan.
That's right up there with She's the Sheriff with Suzanne Summers.
Oh, okay. I thought you were going to say Plachette, but I'll take Summers.
No, it was her big comeback, but it was a complete turd.
Well, I don't want to derail too much. Let's go. What's next?
All right, Bo Beecraft, what do you have for the television round?
Well, strangely enough, gentlemen, 1973, the hottest product in television, the hottest thing going was television itself. According to a survey from the Television Information Office in New York, television was the number one medium in the lives of all classes and economic groups in the United States. So we were all really into the television in 1973.
Sounds like 20.
Yeah. So this organization was started, the TIO, the Television Information Office, started in 1959 to combat potentially harmful criticism stemming primarily from objections by religious groups and other minute fractions of the viewing public. I don't know if this is still around or not, honestly. But it found that 48% of the public views television as having more credibility than newspapers. 33% of the public relies on television only for news information, as compared with 26%, which relies on both TV and newspapers. And only 17%, which rely on only newspapers. Other surveys also revealed 1 in 5 of the total population is against government control of television news. 16% of the population is in favor of more entertainment programs. Boy, if they could see us now. 23% of the population is in favor of more news programs. 37% in favor of more special interest programs, and 24% in favor of more general interest programs. And then another interesting thing I found from this, on the issue of pay television programming, studies since 1963 indicate that only 24% of the population is in favor of pay television, while 72% are not. So, again, if they could see us now, where we're paying for literally every type of streaming service, this is, I mean, I don't want to say I predicted it, but I figured this would happen. I don't want to take credit for the prediction is what I'm saying, that, you know, eventually we'd all cut the cord and we'd be right back to square one where we're paying, you know, for all these different services just to see what we want to see. And here we are in 2020, just paying dollar over dollar for this streaming service and that one, just to assure that we get to see all the content that we want to see. But back to square one, from the Oshkosh Northwestern on Monday, November 26, 1973, television is the hottest thing in television in 1973.
I like that dig. You really went after it for that one. So there was nothing that started, I guess, in November of 1970.
I'm telling you, when I was looking through, everything died after October. It's like, yeah, I think we're just going to call it a year. 73 is in the books. Let's look forward to 74. Yeah, after October, there was virtually nothing of significance as far as television is concerned to report on.
How many streaming packages do you guys have? Do you even know? I just found out the other day that I've been paying for Hulu for like 2 years.
I think we have three. We have Sling, we have Amazon Prime, and I think we have Hulu as well.
Yeah, my friend John Roderick, who has a great podcast called Roderick on the Line, he talks about all these subscription services as he imagines himself as a shark, and all the subscription services are eels that have attached themselves to the shark.
Yes.
So he's like, how many eels do you need? How many eels do you want? It's another eel. You know, like, it's a good way to think about it. Like, make the decision before you press that button. Do you want another eel? Maybe not.
Yeah. It's crazy because if you don't go through with a fine-tooth comb, like, over your bills every month.
Yeah, you don't know what you're paying. There's no way to know.
And then there's the whole, like, well, I want to watch this movie, but it's only available on, you know, some crazy, weird, obscure service. You can sign up for a week for free, and then it kicks in, and you forget, you know. And pretty soon.
Amazon does that shit. Like, I had Shudder for another one. I had for, like, 8 months. I signed up for the free week. And I just had it. And my wife was like, do you watch Shudder? And I was like, oh, we pay for that still?
They bank on that. They bank on that.
Oh, God, it's the worst. Now I'm going to have to go through and look at all the ones I have. Thanks, Bo.
All right, let's throw to Mark for his pick.
All right, so for my pick for television, this one I don't think I ever saw coming. Because why take a product that was developed in 1957 and then marketed in comic books in the 60s and 70s and then turn it into a TV show for kids? Well, possibly the answer was that Howie Mandel, the great Howie Mandel, dropped way too much acid. His idea was to take the popular kids' toy, I guess you could call it, Sea Monkeys. You guys remember the great Sea Monkeys? He developed this TV show based on the Sea Monkeys called The Amazing Live Sea Monkeys. It only ran for 11 episodes, and it came to an unfortunate demise November 28th, 1992. Now, much like Sea Monkeys, if you add water, this show is not coming back. Howie Mandel at the time actually thought this show was going to be bigger than the Ninja Turtles. He created it around three Sea Monkeys characters, Aquarius, Bill, and Dave. Each one of them kind of had an odd quirk. Aquarius couldn't keep a secret. Bill was afraid of Imperial-style beards for some reason. And Dave would grow excited at the sound of polka music. Now, the Sea Monkeys in question are all the brainchild of Howie Mandel's character, who was a mad scientist who, an experiment went wrong, and created sea monkeys into humanoid size and form. How they get all their intelligence is never explained, or lack thereof. So, you have sea monkeys on TV in live action. Now, if you can picture this, it kind of looks like extras from Mac and Me had kids with Cindy Who from the live action Grinch movie. Like, if they had children together, it's just really weird, like foam latex on top of foam latex.
So this wasn't even a cartoon. This was live action.
This was live action. So let's take a look at the cast of this show. Not only did you have the great Howie Mandel, you had Sean Whalen as Aquarius. You had Gilbert Godfrey, and former Dueling Decades judge Vernon Wells was even in this show. He played the shark guy.
I could see that.
So yeah, the very short-lived television show, The Amazing Live Sea Monkeys.
And what nobody seemed to notice was all the episodes were just recycled Walton scripts.
It would have been better if it was.
Good night, Aquarius. Good night, Howie. All right, so I guess it's to me to judge the winner of this round. I got to go with Mark with the Sea Monkeys thing because you know what? After this is over and I have to pee and I'm hungry, but I am going to Google that. Any bodily functions because I have got to see that. The entire time you were talking about it, for some reason, Shelley Long kept popping into my head. I thought you were going to say Shelley Long was in the show, but she wasn't. That's cool. But yeah, that is fascinating and such a train wreck. It makes my fascination with Holmes and Yo-Yo seem like child's play.
All right, so we'll go over to the movies round. I'll go first on this one. I'm not going to defer my pick. So for 1992 movies in November, there was just one that stood out because it was a huge movie for me growing up. And I'm just going to come out and say, ah, salam and good evening to you, my most worthy of friends. Because I am going with Disney's Aladdin, released November 25th, 1992. When looking up reviews for this one, I always like to see what the kids have to say about these movies. You know, what were the children at the time saying? What were we saying? Sometimes, as you've heard on previous episodes, I think these reviews from children are a little bit shady. And I think I might have found another one here in this article. We're going to go to the Jackson Sun. November 23rd, 1992, the headline reads, Fans Flock to Aladdin Preview. And the article goes on to talk about all of the kids who flocked to line up to see an early showing of Aladdin, and then they get to talk to some of the children, and they get their first impressions of it. Becky Colgrove, 11, said she liked everything about the movie, especially the genie. Michael Limp, 7, said he preferred the character of the boy. Others were drawn to other things in the movies, particularly this young lady who says it was good because it showed passionate love between Aladdin and the girl, Victoria Preston, 11 years old. Now, oddly enough, right next to that review, they have a picture of Victoria Preston, who appears to be a young black boy. And then it says it was good and it showed love between Aladdin and the girl in another quote. So I don't know why they took out passionate.
It's kind of weird.
And then Latoya Hunt, 10 years old, liked the happy ending. I liked it because in the movie, the genie got his wish.
That's not the movie I saw.
I don't know what version of Aladdin they saw that had passionate love between Aladdin and the girl and then a happy ending for the genie, but I'm all over it. So that's what I'm picking. Aladdin, November 25th, 1992. Don't have to go into too much detail in this one because we've all seen it 1,000 times. Absolute masterpiece from Robin Williams. And, you know, you got Gilbert Gottfried in there too, who was in my previous pick. So you can't go wrong with that. Disney's Aladdin. Man crush, over to you.
Oh, man. So I got to top that. And I think I have with this one. I got November 27th, 1981. Not much came out the week of Thanksgiving in 1981. So I jumped at the chance to select a movie that dominated HBO in the early 80s. This actually felt like it was on like multiple times a day for years. This is like one of those movies that has like a rolling release date, but it appears that the majority of the bigger theaters got this one, this little Italian gem on the 27th of November. This was written and directed by famous Italian spaghetti Western filmmaker Sergio Corbucci, and it has all the telltale signs of being a foreign-made film, just like the foreign-made low-budget movies that we get these days. They need to have that one American actor that's like on the downside of his career.
Yes. It's his comeback picture.
Yeah, of course, on all of these. But we get the amazing Ernest Borgnine. He gets that pivotal role in this one. And, you know, first off, this movie, it has a big, fat 0% fresh rating on Rotten Tomatoes, so you know this is going to be a fun movie right here. Obviously, this movie, it wouldn't garner a huge box office number or anything. However, in a telltale sign that a movie is beloved, it carries 6,647 reviews on IMDb. And out of that, garners a 6.4 rating. I mean, that's almost unheard of for like any forgotten movie like this one. So if I had to guess, most likely all the people like myself who remember seeing this day after day in like 1983 on HBO, like all the time, they went to IMDb to review the sucker. And aside from like renting like low budget movies, I'd have to say like HBO was probably made me love B movies, that and USA Up All Night. So if you're in the mood for a movie that's like a cross between Greatest American Hero and Police Academy 2, Radiation Exposure, a rookie cop with uncontrollable superpowers, Franco Nero lookalikes, Bourne-Nine being Bourne-Nine, a dude that just won't die, schlocky dubbing with Italian accents, dopey mobsters, and nonsense. Definitely, there's a subplot in this movie about a ventriloquist, which I don't even know where it came from. It's like a dog ventriloquist that the guy has to talk to. I don't know why. Money laundering goes on. It's just a movie that's so bad it's good. But if you're into all that, the 1981 Super Fuzz is the movie you want to go see.
Super Fuzz. Wow. That's also with this torsion pedal that was a big deal in the grunge years here. Yes.
After you watch that that little Howie Mandel number, you can go over to YouTube because this entire movie is there. Oh, and nice. You can watch it. It's pretty wild. It is exactly greatest. Remember the TV show Greatest American Hero? It's Greatest American Hero. And you take the Police Academy First Assignment and you just slap them two together and you get Super Fuzz.
Sold.
Wow.
All right, Bo Beecraft, what do you have for the movies round?
I don't even know where to begin with this. I was about a week late from being able to choose the Charlie Brown Thanksgiving movie or, you know, special, whatever you want to call it, which probably would have fared pretty well here. But instead, I've settled for another international type thing here, and that is The Holy Mountain, released November 29th of 1978. Knew nothing about this movie until I started researching it, and it's actually just so bonkers, more so behind the story than the actual movie itself. Like, I feel like I have to watch this now. It's a Mexican surreal fantasy film directed, written, produced, co-scored, co-edited, also served as a set designer and a costume designer. The guy's name is Alejandro Jodorowsky. The film was produced by the Beatles manager Alan Klein. John Lennon and Yoko Ono actually put up some production money for this movie, if not all of it. I wasn't entirely sure on that aspect of it. It was shown at various international film festivals in 1973, including Cannes and limited screenings in New York and San Francisco. I guess it was like highly anticipated by some of these small, you know, artsy type circles or whatever. It's based on Ascent of Mount Carmel by John of the Cross and Mount Analog by René de Maule. It's been described as a visually psychedelic story following the metaphysical thrust of Mount Analog. So I think that means porn, but I don't know.
I don't even know what that means.
It's like I was saying, though, when I was researching this, the backstory, like what went into making this film is almost more interesting to me than the premise of the film itself. I found that before filming began, that the guy behind the movie and his wife spent a week without sleep under the direction of a Japanese Zen master. Members of the cast spent 3 months doing various spiritual exercises centering around Zen, yoga, all kinds of weird stuff with eclectic concepts drawn from Kabbalah, the teachings of some, you know, other like Zen masters and people like that. After the training, they pretty much lived like in a commune for a month before filming began in 1972. And then the film was shot like sequentially all in Mexico. For $750,000. So a pretty big budget for a movie back in 1973.
Was Jim Jones the director of this?
Yeah. Sunglasses and all. So the guy who's making the film also was instructed by one of his advisors to take LSD while he was making the film. And he also gave the cast members psychedelic mushrooms during the shooting of a scene. On Rotten Tomatoes, this has an approval rating of 82%.
Of course.
Somebody called it a visual treat rich in symbolism. That's pretty much all I know about it at this point until I actually watch it. But it's called The Holy Mountain, released in the U.S. November 29th, 1973. Just a complete mind blow of a story. I want to see the documentary about the making of the film more than I want to see the film.
Right.
My God. Well, since you have like all that cool stuff, I have to throw out with my picture. the lead character, Terrence Hill, he's Italian. So they dub over his voice because this is supposed to take place in like Miami or something. They dub over his voice with an Italian like dialect on top of it. So like, what? You got to listen to it.
Wow. Well, since you threw out that little tidbit of information, I got to throw one about mine. It's Aladdin.
Never Touché. Even seen it.
All right, let's throw it down to Chris Ballou for the final judgment on this game.
Okay, well, gosh, I've got to go with Bo's movie, Bo Beecraft's movie. Well, again, Mount Analog, what is it called?
Mount Analog was one of the Mount books Analog. It was based on.
The Beatles connection alone is making me want to watch it because I'm a massive Beatles fan. I have a biweekly Zoom call with these five other people that we just geek out on the Beatles every 2 weeks.
Well, now you got something to bring to the table during the next chat.
I do. I've never heard of this. And we've scratched every surface, believe me. Recently, we watched Caveman starring Ringo Starr and Barbara Bach, which is surprisingly awesome. And so in the same, it's funny. It's actually funny. It's actually, you know, a well done a sort of, you know, Mel Brooks style comedy. So in the same vein, when you reveal this movie, which is so obscure, but it's got this high rating, I think that's going to be the next thing I Google after I get off this call.
Well, mine had a zero rating on like that. That warrants a viewing.
All right, Bo Beecraft, you know what that means. With the 1 point you picked up in the news round, that actually gives you the win in this game.
Holy shit.
I'm speechless. I don't know what to say. I don't know who to thank. I got to thank Chris Ballou.
Is that unusual? Like, who usually wins? Is there a usual winner?
It's the opposite of the Tom Jones song.
There's not a usual winner, but
it is Bo's unusual.
Bo's been on quite the streak.
Okay. All right. Well,
and not
you know,
the Ray Stevens kind either.
Some of these are just, you know, like darts on a dartboard because they're personally connected with me. So that's where I'm going, you guys.
That's all we can ask for. Hey, Chris, we got a couple questions that people threw out in our Facebook group. Not many. I got two questions. You have a couple minutes to answer those?
Yeah, sure.
All right. So we got Chuck Campbell here. He said he's always wondered, and he said, by the way, this. Which album is it? I guess it was your debut album, I think he's talking about. He said it was one of his favorite albums of all time. He threw that out there. And he said, I've always wondered where they came up with the topics for their songs in this album. Did they conceptually try to make so many songs about animals and insects, or did it just come out that way?
You know, the whole time I was coming of age as a songwriter, I was writing these kind of very serious songs about, they were conceptual or they were about romantic love. And as I was doing that, I was compelled constantly to sing about monkeys and frogs and chickens and pigs. I don't know why. And I always suppressed that. And eventually I just sort of allowed that to happen through a series of experiences, the kind of, you know, not the least of which was taking acid, which was just basically, it was like, be your freaky self was the message after that experience. And I started allowing that to happen. But that also at the time was tempered with discovering like the Stooges and the MC5 and like, you know, rock that had substance to it and grit and passion. But I wanted to then take that and subvert it and sing about ridiculous shit that was me, you know? So I kind of crushed those two together and got the Presidents.
Now, was there anything that was so ridiculous that you didn't record it?
Oh boy. No.
It all went on the album.
When our first guitar player, Dave, left in 2004, we were casting about for who's going to take his place. And Dune Buggy was the song, sort of the cornerstone song, like, okay, we got to find somebody who's good and can rock, but they also have to be able to play without laughing or feeling embarrassed, Dune Buggy.
Right.
Which
right.
is a silly little song. And so, yeah, you know, I think Dune Buggy was the low point of our silliness, and it still made it into the cut. And, you know, it was a single, actually. So
it was pretty awesome. Bo's got a great, Bo, tell that story that you were telling us earlier about Kitty.
Oh, yeah. So when I was working in radio, I had always said, you know, don't have me do the news. It's not something, you know, I don't like to do thing. I'm not like, I'm a lighthearted guy. I don't really like to talk about, you know, news and that kind of stuff. So eventually, because, you know, I was working in radio, I needed to make money to live and eat because I'm a large man. Anyway, they started having me doing all these news stories. So I just make them the most like off the wall things, just not appropriate for, you know, like an AM news radio station. So there came a story. It was kind of like, you know, just pick one of these stories out of this list that we have from the AP or whatever. So there was a story about cat hoarding, like this house that had been hoarding cats, I guess. And I put Kitty in there. So the entire news clip just starts with a meow and plays just gently throughout the rest of the news story. And there's all kinds of just like cat related puns in there. And I got called into the general manager's office the next day, and he's like, you don't have to do the news anymore. You're fine now.
You know, we probably could have used you at the time because we tried to make a video for that song. And we had Roman Coppola, Francis Ford Coppola's son, made all of our videos in the early days. And he was either brilliant or disastrous, and so disastrous that the Kitty video never aired. We never showed it because it costs like $120,000. We had, you know, professional cat actors and mouse actors, and it was and it just came out not great.
You should have tried to get it on the live action Cats recently.
Well, we probably could have used you as the director. You probably should have made the video for us.
I think I just stole random images off Google Images, probably. But I mean, if it's better than the original, I'll take the credit.
Sounds better than what we got. Yeah.
Do you guys still have a copy of that?
Oh yeah, I put it up on YouTube actually. Oh. Just for the hell of it. So you can find it now. You can see it now. But we never gave it to MTV because it just didn't, it was weird. It was all, like, the colors were all brown. It didn't make any sense. But anyway, I love Roman. If, of course, Roman's listening because he listens to your show religiously.
Of course.
But Roman, I don't mean to disparage you. When you were brilliant, you were brilliant. I did call Roman one time to talk about editing on a video, and he was at his dad's vineyard. And when I called, Francis Ford Coppola answered the phone, and I had to be like, "Hello, Mr. Coppola, can Roman come out and play?
And can you do our video for us?"
Yeah, right.
That would be great. I got another question here from Ryan. Ryan, I'm going to butcher your last name, man. We're just going to say Ryan C.
There you go.
Sorry, Ryan. I'll butcher it. He says the topics and imagery are great. Does that come first or does the melody?
I think if I had to pick one of the two, I'd say the topics and imagery. Like, I grew up, when I was a tiny little kid, I got Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band by the Beatles when it came out in 1967, when I was 2.5 years old. Came out in June. I got it in December of 67. What was that? Yeah, 67. Sorry. And it just, that album just made movies go off in my head, made visual. I saw everything they were singing about. And it influenced who I became as a songwriter, because I wanted to swim in those same waters. I wanted to make movies go off in people's heads, like the Beatles, Sgt. Pepper's did for me. So it's the backbone of everything I do, is trying to make something, make a little, like vignette go off in your head, or see what I see, you know? So yeah, visuals first, for sure. I mean, for the good songs. Lump is a completely visual song. Like, I just pictured this woman. Everybody asks, like, what's Lump about? Well, it's about what the lyrics say it's about. It's literally a woman in a house coat sitting in a river in the Amazon confusing the piranhas. I don't know why, but that's what it is.
What were you on when you wrote that one?
I don't remember, because you know what? I don't remember writing that song. I have these I had a little micro cassette recorder, and I would record ideas, and then I would listen to them. I would plug it into an amplifier and, you know, do the dishes or something mindless and listen and wait for something to catch my ear. And that caught my ear, and it was me singing that. And I do not remember making it up, but there I am singing it on tape. So it must have been me. I don't remember. Peaches, however, I was definitely on LSD when I wrote that.
And you were just like digging peaches right then? You were just...
Well, no, I went. Peaches. I had a crush on a girl. I went to her house, and she lived in a cartoonishly incongruous house in a low kind of industrial part of Boston, like one-story little machine shops. And her house looked like the house that the grandma and Tweety Bird lived in the Warner Brothers cartoon. It was like a yellow Victorian white gabled thing with a peach tree in the yard. And I went to finally tell her. I took acid. I left the house. I was living with Mark Sandman from Morphine at the time. I just walked down the street a couple blocks, went to her house, and she wasn't there. So I sat under her peach tree, just like crushing peaches in my hands, waiting for her. But she never came home, and I went off for the rest of the trip and went home and channeled my frustration into the song.
That's great. What about Kitty?
Kitty was a cat that Mark Sandman, again, the guy that I lived with, who's from a band called Morphine in Boston, his roommate had a cat named Chima, and Chima was a black cat who would just come up to you and like rub on your leg and purr, and then you'd reach down to pet Chima, and Chima would just like gouge your hand. So, and it was a jam. We were jamming on this riff, and Chima came into the room, and I was recording everything at the time, and I started singing to the cat, Kitty at my foot, and I want to touch it.
So pretty much any lyrics that people read of yours, that is what happened.
They're literal.
The lyrics are the lyrics.
They're pretty literal. They're like, you know, real things. But then they take on a life of their own, and I love that. I love that they kind of, the poetic layer of telling the story that makes it sort of universal and kind of mysterious. And, you know, like I love Lump. Lump to me is one of my most proud, a moment of songwriting that I'm most proud of, because it's super abstract, but it's also very much visual, and it's like compelling, but confusing, and, you know, evocative, but like abstract. So I'm, that's that song.
It's like the perfect 90s track.
Yeah, and that's a song where when we were playing live, I was never bored for 1 second playing that song. Every time we played it, it was like it was a new song. So that's I got to say that Lump, I think, is my pinnacle, top.
That segues really good into my next question, and it's a question that we really like to ask people here on Dueling Decades. Tell us a crazy story from the road. You know, you guys played all over the United States as the presidents of the United States of America. So what were some of the crazy things that happened?
Wow. I mean, the touring part was not that crazy, really. There's other things that were crazy, like getting, you know, career advice from Madonna.
What was her advice?
Well, you know, I'll tell this story instead of like the road thing. You know, it's really just like a huge amount of boredom, punctuated by tiny bits of adrenaline when you're playing live. So, and we were very like kind of pro and focused. We wanted to go out, do our job, entertain people, come home with money. So we didn't like have excesses or any wackadoo shit while we're on tour. But we did meet with Madonna. She wanted to sign us. So we narrowed it down to Columbia and Maverick, her label. And we had a business meeting with her. She came to see us live the night before. I could totally knew it was her. She's in the back of the room with like the telltale giant sunglasses, hat, and the ponytail coming out and the sweats. I'm like, that's a star. Who the hell is that? So anyway, we go to meet her the next day. And the whole story is amazing. So we're there on time because we were terminally punctual. She's late. We are restless. We go out in the parking lot. We're tossing around a little Nerf football that we had with us on tour to kind of, you know, just alleviate boredom. And eventually the door to the hallway, to the, you know, building opened up and a worker bee stuck his head out and said, "Oh, she's here. Come on in." Everybody filed in, but I was kind of feeling like lazy and I was throwing the ball up in the air to myself. And I kind of thought to myself, could I throw myself a pass into the hallway through the open door? Great. I did it and I caught it. And when I came down, I felt something next to my foot. And at the time I had these really thick, sort of leather boots on. And I felt something next to my foot and I looked down and it was her dog. Chihuahua that was, I had bounded into this hallway and this dog was right next to my boot. If I had been a centimeter to the left, I would have crushed this dog. And it's me alone with the dog. And I look down and I'm just like, my heart is pounding and the dog is looking at me shaking. And I just like moved my foot away and the dog took off around the corner. And so I'm all like nervous and I go into the room where we're going to like receive her and she's still not there. So I'm, restless and I'm looking through all the like, books on the bookshelf, titles and stuff. And she must have come in the room and done this, been like, shh, because she came in the room and nobody said a thing. It was quiet. And she came right behind me and vigorously tapped me on the shoulder. And I turned around and Madonna's face was like right in my face, just like 3 inches away from me. And so again, I'm just like, heart pounding. So, and then we have a really pleasant meeting and she gets us and she understands that, like, we work really hard at what we do. Well, it's like we care deeply with while appearing to not care at all, that kind of like, thing. She gets it. So we have a great meeting. And during, of course, she's wearing this like silver suit with a black bra. And every time she bends over, the entire suit opens up and it's just, this
totally on purpose
Madonna show. I'm like, eyes up, eyes up, eyes up. And at the end, she kind of took me aside and said, this is the part that stuck with me, of course, is she kind of said, look, whether you sign with me or not, what you do is fun and it's funny. And so nobody will ever give you critical acclaim or acknowledgement for the craft that goes into what you do. So don't expect it. Just, bank on your relationship with your fans, bank on your craft, and ignore the pop, culture feedback.
The critics. Yeah.
And she ended up being right. And it saved me a lot of heartache. So who knew that the woman who would not get off the radio when I moved to New York in 1983 to go to college, I was like, there will be Madonna songs on the radio for the rest of my life. I thought, it was everywhere. Who knew that that person that I was sort of like, I'm so tired of this person, would end up giving me some of the best career advice that I ever got.
That was wild. What year was that?
That was a long story. That was when we met again. That was, 1994, I want to say.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that is wild.
We eventually signed with Columbia, of course, and that worked out great for us. So
they didn't have any dogs at the meeting?
I will say that during the time we were sitting there waiting for Madonna, her assistant, Guy Osiri, played us a cassette from a Canadian artist they just signed named Alanis Morissette. And if we had signed with Maverick, we would have been the little stepchild to that, thing. As it is, we signed to Columbia. We saved their bottom line for a couple of years. We were the heroes and got the attention we needed. So it all worked out.
So that's pretty cool. They had she had Candlebox signed with Maverick too, didn't they?
Yes.
I think they were first.
I talked to one guy from Candlebox on the phone about it before we signed. Like, what's your experience? All that kind of stuff. So we had a phone call. I don't remember much about it, but I don't want to disparage Candlebox, but.
Well, no, that's funny. That's the other band that was, Kevin Martin was on the show.
That's right. That's
who. Holy
right.
Shit.
I might have talked to him. I don't remember which member it was that I talked to, but I got to say, I don't know. Maybe I should watch the video again now, but it's always been my feeling that the lead vocals are completely out of tune on that song. Like they're at like half a step flat. And I can't listen to it, but maybe it's me. Maybe I've got some ear blockage. Maybe I've got some ear wax that I need to get out. So nothing against.
We'll have to get you both on at the same time. You guys can hash that one out. But tell us about Casper Baby Pants before you get out of here, because I know that, like, that's your new thing, and that's a ton of albums you were talking about before.
Yeah,
in a short span of time.
Latest album. Wait, I threw it over here. Hold on. Okay, got it. Latest album is Happy Heart. It's my 18th album in 10 years as Casper Baby Pants. I kind of, you know, during the president's experience, I had this impulse or this gut feeling that I needed to be doing something else. And the president's wasn't my destination, even though it was a great stepping stone to whatever I was supposed to be doing. I didn't know. So I experimented on the side, and eventually those experiments led to this, like, really simple, acoustic, innocent kind of storytelling type songwriting. And I didn't know who it was for, and realized after listening back to a bunch of it that, oh, it's for little kids. And I felt immediately, like, free of all the culture of cool and being the hot, you know, thing or whatever, you know, being on any sort of MTV or radio fell away. And it was all about just, like, serving families. So obviously I found my voice because I made so much music in a, you know, 10-year span. And so this is album number 18, Happy Heart. And then album number 19 is going to be my last as Casper Baby Pants. And then I'm moving on. I'm starting a new thing that I'm working on, that hasn't quite taken form yet, but it's loud, distorted fuzz guitar, sort of, I don't know what, heavy, trancy, spiritual rock. I don't know how to describe it.
Nice.
You should watch The Holy Mountain before you start working on that.
So anyway, yeah, that thing is great, though. I mean, it's been an incredible experience, and families are incredibly grateful for it. I want to bring, like, parents and kids into the same room to genuinely enjoy the same music and kind of, like, strengthen the family through that, you know, kind of experience, that shared aesthetic. And it seems to be working. And so I'm super proud of that project. It's fantastic.
Yeah, that's super awesome. That's a great idea too. I mean, I have a 14-year-old, so I know how to, you know, if we can watch anything together.
Yeah.
Or listen to anything together. It's fantastic. So that's amazing. Cool. Do you go on, like, tours for that kind of thing? Are you, like, showing up at elementary schools to, like, play for kids or stuff? Like, how does that work now?
I toured with the rock band so many years, I just burned out on that aspect of it. And with the kids music scene, you got to kind of, like, go to different regions and grow your thing. And I just, I just don't have it in me anymore. So, you know, primarily I made this stuff to be recordings, to work in the home as recordings, and that was the purpose. Playing live came as an afterthought, but I play live regionally like crazy. I mean, there were a couple of years in 2017, 18, 19, where I was doing, like, you know, 250 shows a year. I've done over 1,200 shows as Casper, and the president's, I think, got to 580 or so. So,
wow.
Yeah, I've done a lot of shows, but all regional, like, you know, I went to, what do you call it? Australia.
Oh, that's pretty awesome.
I went to Australia. I've gone to Hawaii, gone to Australia, gone to Mexico, done a few one-offs, but mostly it's regional. So my idea with the presidents back in the day was, like, why don't we just make it so if you want to see the band, you have to come to Seattle, you know, make it like, all right, we're the hottest
destination.
Thing on MTV. You got to come to Seattle to see us, see us in our natural environment. And of course, I got shouted down. You got to go on tour. So now I've run that experiment with Casper, and it's worked. It's worked for me. And I have actually people come to shows. Entire families are like, we're from Michigan, and we just came all the way to Seattle to see you. So
that's
I like
awesome.
It. It works for me. Excuse me. It works for me. And it seems to create special experiences for those families who care. So
that's amazing, man. Before you get out of here, you want to tell people where they can find your stuff?
Yeah.
And best, do all that plug stuff.
Katie, the best first stop shop is babypantsmusic.com. And there's another site, chrisbaloo.org, where you can get my meditation music, and some weird stuff I call sampledelic. I also make visual art now, which I've been doing for the last 7 years. You can find that there. And then my wife, Kate, is the artist who does all the art on the albums. Her website is kateendle.com, kateendle.com. She's dancing in the background trying to make me like promote her.
That's fantastic.
Endle with a G, not a G, just so you know.
There you go. It's Endle. So
you know. All right. Well, great. Thanks a lot for coming on, man. You can come back anytime, and I can't wait to listen to whatever you got coming out soon.
Yeah.
I mean, once you change things up, I mean, I'll listen to the kids' stuff too, but like I said, my daughter's getting a little old now. I don't even know which. I had this conversation with somebody today. I asked her, I said, what's your favorite music? And she's like, I don't have any. And I was like, yeah, at 14.
I think that's good. I mean, I don't have any either. I'm like, I like songs. I like great songs.
Yeah.
I don't care what genre they're in, who made them. A great song trumps any style.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
Yeah. Well, thanks for having me. This was delightful. I think you guys are great. I'd love to do it again sometime in the future.
All right. Great. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Thanks a lot.
You guys
Chris.
Have a great night and enjoy your holiday.
Thank you. You too. Stay safe and stay healthy and wear your masks.
Will do.
Take care, man.
Okay, bye.
Thanks a lot. See you, man. Take care.
All right, duelers. Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to end this episode right here. Congratulations again to Bo Beecraft for picking up the win in this episode. And if you missed an episode, you can always head back to our website, www.duelingdecades.com, where you can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Spotify, really everywhere podcasts are available. And while you're on those interwebs, head on over to facebook.com/duelingdecades, where you can join our private group and share some of your very own retro memories. So until next time, duelers, we're going to bid you a peace, love, light, and a joy. Have a grateful week, everyone.
Infirmary Media.